It's a mess.
Are we getting back to Elon Musk? Because I hear tunnels underground.
Ooh, and I think Hyperloop.
That would be amazing. That would probably need to be federally funded.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Wonkcast, the independent student podcast of the George Washington University's Trachtenberg School of Public Policy and Public Administration. My name is Jessica Blackband. I'm a first-year MPP student here at GW, concentrating in environmental policy, and I'll be moderating this episode. We have two of our lovely co-hosts on the pod today, Natalia.
Hi, my name is Natalia Abrahams. I am a first-year MPP student focusing on refugee and immigration resettlement policy.
And Gabe.
I'm Gabe Moss. I'm a first-year MPP student focusing on housing affordability and urban policy.
Excellent. And we have a wonderful guest with us today, Grace Mauser. Grace, do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Hi, everyone. My name is Grace Mauser. I'm a second-year MPP student studying urban policy and public economics. And in particular, I'm really interested in land use policy and urban transportation.
Awesome. Which is the topic of today's podcast. We're going to chat a little bit about urban transportation and its intersections with policy. So to kick us off, this isn't a topic that I know a whole lot about, but apparently it's something people are really interested in. The American Public Transportation Association released a survey last year and showed that the number of Americans who support increasing federal public transportation investment increased to nearly 68%, which is a huge number. So clearly, this is an issue that affects a lot of people's lives. And so I wanted to ask you, I know that when Trump first came to the presidency, he talked a lot about infrastructure investment at the federal level. And so I wanted to kind of kick off the conversation, if you could give us kind of an update on what's going on, at least at the federal level, in terms of investment in transportation policy. If you know, I'm curious.
I don't know a ton about federal transportation policy, because that kind of, a lot of that focuses on block grants to states, which in turn tend to do like bigger projects with like land, air, sea, highway sort of stuff. So the
public transportation that, like, let's say that we experience here in DC and that we use in DC or in New York or Boston, is a lot of that funded then at the state or municipal level, or do they depend a lot on federal grants for their work?
Well, so it's both. Mm-hmm. I mean, cities have a lot of leeway over how they distribute funds for local transportation. That's why, you know, some cities have subway systems and others don't. Yeah. And some have great sidewalk systems and others have barely any sidewalks. That's not solely funded by cities. Cities generally don't generate enough revenue. So it does kind of trickle down from the federal level, and the federal government does sometimes give guidelines suggesting how a city might use some money.
Right.
I think recently they suggested that cities focus more on sidewalks, more on walkability, but that didn't have any teeth. So a lot of the actual policymaking is happening at the local level. The federal government isn't mandating anything in particular.
Yeah, so you mentioned walkability. That term gets thrown around a lot in the environmental community, I'm sure, as well in the transportation community. What is walkability? Is there like a working definition for that, or does it look different in every city?
I think there is a working definition, and it also looks different in every city. So walkability, to my understanding, is how easily can you navigate a space on foot?
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just how easy, but also how pleasant is it to navigate a space on foot?
Mm-hmm.
There may be a sidewalk for you to use to get from point A to point B, but if all you're walking by is an empty parking lot, maybe you don't feel safe using that. Maybe if the sidewalk is really narrow and the street's really big, you don't want to use that because there's too many cars. You feel like you might get hit by a car. If there's a sidewalk but no crosswalk, how would you navigate that space? So I think it's a combination of aesthetics and accessibility that define walkability, and it's become increasingly important in real estate markets.
Mm-hmm.
People who want to live in cities want to live in walkable places.
And so we're talking a lot about like public transportation. Is the definition of public transportation, does that include walking and like capital bike share, those kind of things? Is that included in the definition of public transportation?
I would say it's not included in the traditional definition, but increasingly it is, and I think it should be. Cities are becoming more concerned with walkability, in part because real estate markets are becoming more concerned with walkability, but cities want to discourage car use. Traffic is a public bad, right? It's not good for people's health. It's not nice to look at. It's not good for the environment. So cities are trying to think creatively about other methods of public transportation to use. And I think increasingly people are looking at walking. How can we get people to walk? It can also, I wouldn't call this public transportation, but some cities are partnering with rideshare. Some cities in Florida are doing that right now, actually. So I think governments are getting really creative with what works for their city, especially because cities are so different. DC was built to be walkable. New York was built to be walkable. Boston was built to be walkable because of when they were built. Houston, LA, a lot of Midwestern cities, not built to be walkable. If they were developed primarily in the 20th century, they're going to be built around cars.
Yeah, trying to walk around Seattle is just a maze.
Yeah.
It's horrendous.
Yeah. So we're talking a lot about like walkability. I think on another podcast we had talked about development and like urbanization and like gentrification and like affordable housing. I feel like right now what I hear from like a lot of people is that when they're picking an apartment, they want it to be close to like a lot of things so they don't have to travel far. Like, they want grocery stores around the corner. They want, like, this is why we have a SoulCycle on every other street. Like, this is, you know what I mean? So how much of that, like, how much is this walkability also contributing to like gentrification and like pushing a bunch of lower class people out because they can't afford what's happening with gentrification? Like, they can't afford to always go to SoulCycle or like different yoga studios or things like that. But I guess you can say like people with more money can, and their ability to walk to all those things is like even better. And so that's what's pushing this whole like walkability. Or do you think it's more of like a public health kind of thing? It's like, okay, we know that obesity or like health issues, heart disease are an issue. What if we have everything closer together, encourage more people to walk, get up, moving around?
So you mean like where is that sort of incentive to create walkability coming from?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Is it coming from just like simply a business side or like?
I think it's from gentrification. Like, you're saying it's driving gentrification. I think it's the result. I think.
Yeah. No, it's from. Is it coming from like, is that incentive?
I don't think it's a new thing to want to be able to walk around your community. I just think it's new that we're listening to communities east of the river. We're listening to communities that used to be low income areas because rich people live there, white people live there. Now we listen to them, right? Like, it's not new to want to have exercise equipment near your house, to have bikes, to have accessibility, to have workable public transit, walkable, safe cities. It's just we spent decades ignoring people asking for it.
Well, and it's like you can only benefit from, like, the walkable community if you live in walking distance of the walkable community, which a lot of lower-income people don't benefit from that. One of the articles that you sent was about Houston and how they're thinking about, they've got all of these, I guess, zoning laws that make it kind of...
They actually don't have any zoning laws.
Oh!
Wait, what?
Houston doesn't have any zoning laws. They have... No, it's okay. So they have parking requirements. Zoning laws are like how the land should be used.
Oh, okay, okay.
And they have no zoning laws. Oh my God.
So what does that mean? So like... Like, a Target can be built here, but, like, right next to Target, we can build a house?
Well, so, zoning in D.C. would be, like, this area can be an industrial area.
Yeah.
So, like, this area could have light industry, so maybe a brewery could go there. This area is a residential area, and only this type of house can go there. So, like, in Northeast and Northwest, you see some single-family detached houses. Those are inherently less walkable. But that's because they're zoned like that. Where you see townhouses, it's zoned to be single-family dwellings attached. Where you see apartments, it's zoned to be, like, residential apartment. So, that's how zoning works in most cities, and I think almost all cities except for Houston.
So, this might be diverting a little bit, but what does racial zoning look like in Houston? Because in every other city, right, you can just look on a map and pick the parts where people were forced to live and directly trace
any sort of inequality, police abuse, drug use, like pretty much everything, right? I shouldn't say drug use, drug criminalization and policing, right? You can trace all of that to that zoning. So is Houston an anomaly in that there isn't, or did it come about naturally the other way?
There's definitely segregation.
Yeah, so I'm from Houston. We're not a racial utopia. So how it worked there wasn't the same kind of explicit redlining. Well, there was, because the redlining came from the Federal Housing Authority,
which
didn't operate off of zoning laws. It was like, this neighborhood gets this grant, this neighborhood gets that grant. So Houston just didn't have the zoning racism, but it had every other kind.
Okay.
So, but I wanted to go back to, I guess, a point we were making before about, like, gentrification.
Yeah.
I think it's kind of a loop. I don't think it's that, I mean, Gabe, you said everyone wants walkability. Mm-hmm. Like, everyone wants everything that comes with gentrification, right? Like, poor people aren't like, no, I hate coffee shops.
that's fair.
So, it's kind of a loop, I think, that can most easily be pinpointed to like urban renewal in the mid-20th century, when a lot of poor neighborhoods and a lot of minority neighborhoods were targeted with urban redevelopment. So a lot of neighborhoods were raised, mm-hmm. highways were built mm-hmm. in place of them, and so they became, and now that we like walkability, those places, because they have highways in the middle of them and have buildings that were built in the mid-20th century, are inherently less walkable.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see that in DC in Southwest. The Southwest neighborhood
mm-hmm.
that is separated by the highway was a predominantly Black neighborhood until they destroyed the entire neighborhood and displaced thousands of people to build the highway there. Mm-hmm. And now that neighborhood, because of the highway, is separated from the majority of DC, and it's hard to walk across the highway as hard, much as you may want to. You really have to work at that.
You can go down underneath, but then you gotta climb up Key Bridge, which is just...
It sounds like a process. I'm tired.
So it's like these neighborhoods that were more marginalized by those urban developments are now less walkable and less desirable by people who want to walk, which is everyone, but the people who can afford to walk don't usually live in those neighborhoods.
But I feel like... I mean, I always want to be able to walk. So, like, I don't live in the city, but I live in Alexandria.
Mm-hmm.
And the neighborhood I live in, much cheaper than if I was living here. And, like, I feel like I'm getting more bang for my buck, and I can still walk everywhere. But I feel like but I also think about the transportation costs in which I pay to come into the city.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, okay, should I consider moving into the city? Because will I make it up in not having to pay all those transportation mm-hmm. costs? And I feel like that's also, like, a huge concern for a lot of people
yeah.
in terms of, okay, but if I move into the city, am I really going to make up those transportation costs, even mm-hmm. if, you know, using public transportation, even though it is heavily subsidized, does it really outweigh, or should you just stay where you are, kind of thing?
Yeah.
What do you think?
I mean, I think it also depends on what kind of housing you want. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people move to, a lot of Americans just seem to prefer suburbs. Like, they want the single, I don't know what kind of house you live in, but seem to prefer, like, the detached house, larger mm-hmm. lots, larger lawns, and so they're willing to pay the price in terms of transportation, whether that's in commute time or in dollars and gas money, to have that. A lot of people feel that it's cheaper to live outside of the city and commute in.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that's actually true, I'm not totally sure. It probably depends on the system that the city uses.
So for me, yeah. for a concrete example, this is not statistically relevant in any measure and should not be applied to anyone else's experience, but I spend around $140 a month commuting 5 days a week to D.C. It's $4 each way because I have to take a bus and a train. $8 a day in Arlington.
Oh, okay.
So not that far, but because of the way DC does its prices,
mm-hmm.
it's $8 a day, you know, 5 days a week,
yeah.
four weeks in the month. I spend about half what I would on housing, right? I would spend probably another $500, $600 if I lived in the same sized apartment in DC.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm saving a considerable amount of money for the space mm-hmm. that I want. I just have to spend maybe 30 minutes, 40 minutes in public transit.
Like, Alexandria isn't that far.
Yeah.
From the city, but I would spend double in transportation time
yeah,
than
just,
you do.
Just because you have to go up into Roslyn along the Potomac and then across.
Which also brings back to transportation, like the way in which the public transportation in the city is structured is not really conducive to like
it's designed to bring people in from Springfield and Wheel and Reston.
I think this kind of speaks to how important regional cooperation is in urban transportation. So DC and Maryland and Virginia are actually okay at regional cooperation on this. I mean, WMATA, although it's not very well funded, is shared by all three jurisdictions.
And the federal government.
So it has a lot of problems, don't get me wrong, but I mean, Virginia made concerted efforts to develop lines, right? So there actually are lines there. Whereas other cities, the public transportation system might only exist in the urban core. Or like in New York, there's the subway system, but then the commuter lines that go outside of the city are controlled by different agencies. So a commuter might have to kind of figure out the pricing to get from Long Island to, say, Penn Station, and then Penn Station, then they transfer systems to get to wherever they need to go in the city. So DC actually has, I think, an okay system. Not perfect for everyone, but in terms of regional cooperation, I think it's okay.
I will say that coming from, so I grew up in Connecticut, and we are obviously very close to New York.
Oh, yeah.
So I can tell you, though, that they have, like, a lot of different venues and ways you can get in and out of the city to, like, its surrounding areas. And they run, I believe they run more consistently, they're more frequent, and there's more of them.
Yeah.
So, and coming here to D.C., I was so used to that type of system that I was like, oh, it's going to be like that. And, like, that has not been very much my experience. There's, like, so Jessica and I were talking before the show, and we're both like, yeah, we can only take one line home.
Honestly, though, I'm from North Florida, and I'm, like, baffled that the Metro is a thing and gets me anywhere. No public transportation whatsoever growing up.
I mean, that speaks to what I was saying earlier, that every city is, like, is so radically different.
Yeah.
Because I'm the same. I'm from Houston.
Yeah.
And I came here and I was like, whoa, I don't need a car. This is amazing.
What? This is amazing.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not thinking, so not like, oh, I only have one line.
No, I'm thinking like,
it's nice to have any line.
Cool,
you know?
Magic train that I get on and it like takes me to the city. It's so cool.
But I mean, I think that speaks to how different the cities are in their development. I mean, New York was a really early investor.
The first subway in the United States.
Yeah, and it actually has the most stops in the world, which is weird because it's not the biggest system in the world. That might be actually a little inefficient, but I digress. and so them and Boston and Chicago had a pretty early system, but DC, we built ours in the middle of the 20th century, and we were pretty much the only one who built it at that time. I think BART was the other one that was built.
BART's San Francisco.
Yeah. Oh, and BART is not awful. Nearly as big as we are. So given that context, it's a pretty okay system, given when it was built, how many people were pushing for more car-centric cities during the 50s and 60s. But yeah, it's hard to compare systems because
so much
is
of it,
so
like you mentioned, is a cultural. It would be so weird to me not to have a car. Like that just seems so odd.
Do you have a car in the city?
I actually do because I have free parking in my apartment complex. I don't know how willing people in Texas would be to kind of give up their cars, if that's part of what's preventing better public transportation.
So I will say, at least from being a Californian, the construction of California cities came after the advent of the automobile in large part, right? I mean, obviously Los Angeles, San Francisco, Sacramento, all of those predated automobiles by a long shot, but the modern iterations of those cities are all built around large freeways, large automobiles, large roads. So if you're going to design a public transit system that's going to work in, say, Palo Alto, you can't do it like you do it in DC. There's just, you know, DC's 10 square miles minus what Virginia took back right before the Civil War. So that's a small area, but Palo Alto just spreads and spreads, and then it turns into, you know, the Silicon Valley. Like, it's just this huge sprawling mass of concrete that, you know, I guess you could drill under, but, you know, there's just not an efficient way to route something through it, which speaks to why BART is so inefficient.
And that kind of gets back to the hubs of walkability. So if you can, that's what Houston's trying to do. They have a relatively new city planner who's trying to make parts of the city walkable and recognizes that you would have to drive in between.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. A problem with that, of course, is who's deciding what parts of the city get to be hubs, right? And then you still have people left out if there's not a good way to get in between the hubs without a car, because cars are expensive. Most people have them in Houston, but a lot of people don't. So.
I mean, I grew up with a car. Like, I was not near one of the towns that got you into New York. Like, I come from a very small, very, like, white town in Connecticut. You know, everybody has a car. Unless you're, like, a major city. Because even Boston, people still drive a bunch.
Mm-hmm.
And not everybody takes the T.
I mean, New York has a ton of traffic.
Yeah. Or at least what I've noticed from being down here is I have friends who have cars. And they use their cars on a regular basis. Versus, like, my parents would tell me when they were in New York, they had one car, and they would park it. And they only used it when they were driving to go visit family in Connecticut. Mm-hmm. So I think that's, like, the different mentalities. Like, yeah, you have a car, but you have a car because, like, you know you're going to need it. It's just, like, something you have. Like, you know you always have, like, those pair of running shoes. You may not always be running, but, like, you have those. Yeah, or, like, okay, hiking shoes. You're not always hiking every day, but you have your pair of hiking shoes when you're ready to go. That's kind of the car thing, like, in New York, or maybe even Boston. But I feel like in D.C., people, like, drive on, like, a regular basis. Yeah. Like, that's... So,
speaking of driving, how common is congestion pricing as an approach to...
In the U.S.?
Yeah, in the U.S. No.
I don't really think any city has it in the U.S. I would need to fact check that, but yeah. I'm pretty
sure. Is there
a
reason why? Is it just, like, politically unpopular? Or
yeah, I mean, drivers are a really powerful political constituency.
There are a lot of them.
And it's hard to get things like that passed. Mm. I think New York may do it in the next 5 years. They are seriously considering congestion pricing.
Yeah.
What is that? I'm sorry. What does that mean?
Yeah, sorry.
So congestion pricing is when you charge people to use a road based on how popular it is. It's kind of like
a toll
pricing. It's like a toll. Yeah. But
or like peak pricing on Uber or Lyft just for like the whole road.
So it would be congestion pricing is usually distinguished from like tolls. Because it is pricing to get you into a part of the city, usually the central business district. So in New York, that would probably be the south of Central Park to Midtown from 9 to 5 p.m. You have to pay X amount to be in there.
With your car.
So what is that? Not walkers.
Yeah. No, I know. But so, like, how does that look? Is it going to be like the new tolls where they just take a picture of your license plate and they... We'll send it to you, or is it going to be like a little man, like in a booth, and like
I think
you pay a dollar?
It would probably be instituted at the entrance points to Manhattan. So when you come under a tunnel or across a bridge in your car, and you're heading into Midtown or whatever place they designate, that's when you would pay.
So we already have a version of that, not like. Bar, you can't come in, but we expedite travel into cities using easy passes, which is essentially the same thing, right? You're you're offering someone to pay more for expedited travel in. So that's kind of the same thing, or is the, like
so
I mean,
it's the idea is not expedited travel. So that's kind of you're paying for a perk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is trying to deter you from being there.
So you can't come in if you don't pay.
So the idea is like we're trying to incentivize you to use public transportation or carpool or something like that.
Because you're going to have to pay to come into that person.
Not just you pay to go a little bit quicker through.
Yeah.
And would the proceeds be used to subsidize the public transit system?
That would depend on how the city structures it. In New York, one of the more popular proposals, it would be.
Mm-hmm.
It would be used. Actually, I think the specific idea is to put the funding into the subway system to help with the repairs that they're going through right now.
It's a really cool idea.
So one thing we were talking about before you got here was discriminatory pricing in fares for public transit and how you can look at public transit pricing model as price discrimination against poor people. Right, they're statistically the most likely group to use the public transit system because they can't afford transportation. And at the same time, they have the least amount of funds to pay for it, and the prices are fixed, not varied by income. And I proposed the theoretical ideal world where the government owns all transportation systems and everything is free. You can travel for free wherever you want to go.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone. Jess and Natalia both thought that was really stupid.
It's not what I think. I think I can't imagine the kind of inefficiency.
So many inefficiencies.
Essentially, it would become like useless to everyone.
But I'm not saying only the network that exists now becomes free. I'm saying ideal world theory, government owns all modes of transportation and makes them all free and accessible to everyone. All cars, for instance, are automated cars that run.
Like
routes.
Elon Musk. Like, I feel this is once again,
I don't have a problem with that. It's just so far beyond the realm of constraints that I don't,
the more,
I don't know how to talk about it.
Yeah,
you know?
so the more realistic version of that hypothetical craziness is subsidizing public transit costs either through free passes or something else using regressive income taxes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there should be more like, something I haven't, unless, correct me if I'm wrong, because I don't feel like I've seen this, but I know they have it, like, in Boston, New York, like, where you can get subsidized Metro cards.
You can get...
Even if you're in college or graduate school. So, like, yeah. But that's not something I've seen.
Yeah. Well, so there's a couple of ways that DC does it. Seniors do have access to lower costs. Mm-hmm. All DC public school students ride anything for free. Mm-hmm. You probably notice there aren't school buses in the city. That's because
there aren't.
Yeah, right. That's because they're all on public transportation. Some universities do it because WMATA. They offer universities all or nothing. Either every student gets one or none of them get one. There's no opt-in clause. Yeah.
So it's like you automatically get signed up for it once you become a student of that.
Yeah. So the university would have to say, okay, we'll pay you $5 million a year so that every student gets one. And then we'll also raise the cost of tuition for all these students who don't take the subway. So,
Okay. That actually, I feel that.
It's just disappointing that the government hasn't taken a step towards offering these services, right? Like, it's fine and fair for nonprofits to operate helping low-income individuals. Mm-hmm. But for the government to make a system designed to enfranchise low-income folks who can't afford to drive into the city for whatever reason, and then not to make that available to those people.
I mean, the metro, I understand that the prices are high, but they're still massively subsidized compared to other methods of transportation into the city. And there's a point at which, like, first of all, if the government is going to, like, free transportation for everyone, that's going to be so massively expensive, and I'm just, like, a little worried about where that
sure. So let's scrap the free transportation for everyone ideas. Okay. What I'm suggesting is a system whereby, like TANF or SNAP, depending on your income level, you get direct subsidies from the government to pay for your transportation costs. Mm-hmm. Now, ideally, that might come in the form of universal basic income, where you get to decide exactly how your money is spent. But until we can all agree on that, maybe a good way to do it is offering some sort of subsidized ride fare.
The way DC is set up, it's set up kind of like a traditional city, that in the sense, like, if you had lower income way back in the heyday, you lived in the city.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you had more money, you wanted the big house, and you know what I mean? You wanted the yard, so you lived in the suburbs. And so, theoretically, you could pay more to commute into the city.
Mm-hmm.
But now that has completely switched, and I just don't think DC has caught up with that. And I'm not saying we should all of a sudden, like, make things more expensive in the city.
Right.
No, that's not what I'm saying. But I think they should just recognize that, like, there's a reason a lot of people commute in from the burbs. It's not because we want to, it's because, like, we have to. Yeah. So,
one way that DC actually does, this isn't quite what you're talking about, but the DC metro system does subsidize a little bit for people living in the city taking shorter trips. Because the system, you pay more the farther you go, which is pretty unique to the DC system. Mm-hmm. So actually how the pricing scheme works, the people who live further away, are kind of subsidizing people going just a few stops, and just to push back on you a little bit, there are still significant portions of the city that have a lot of low income residents.
Oh, yeah.
In fact,
the
average median income of the city proper is still much lower than almost all of the surrounding counties.
But if you go ward by ward, the people
living in the low-income wards are not connected by robust public transit networks to the public transit system. So they, by far, are receiving the least amount of that benefit. The most subsidization goes to people who can live in and around Capitol Hill, on the west side of Capitol Hill, live in Adams Morgan, in NoMa, in all these acronym rebuilt up places that got bus networks.
Which, until recently, were also predominantly low-income.
Yeah, it's super recent. Because, like I said, like, East Street, on the rise. It's real nice. But I remember talking to, like, old coworkers, and they were like, dude, I remember back when such and such place was rough and you didn't go out there. And
that's actually where I live. I live kind of on the further east side of the H Street corridor, and a lot of my neighbors talk about how they kind of have moved back, or that I wouldn't have been living there 10 years
yeah,
ago.
Yeah, and it's not like it's not like these people are like old. I feel like we always picture when people say things like that.
40-year-olds.
Yeah, they're all like 40, like 35, some of them. They're like, no, I remember back when. And you always think about like your old grandpa like sitting on the porch, but these are like young people.
Yeah.
That are saying that. And so that's so crazy how quickly.
Well, that's what's special and scary of DC, right? Is gentrification. We've seen it in our lifetimes. Yeah. And it's projected to have 1.5 million people, is the number they're throwing around, move to the Maryland, DC, Virginia area within the next 20 to 40 years. So that's, you know, if we're talking public transit strain, economic strain, financial market strain, housing strain, right? This is all just increased cost. An increased burden, it's going to increase traffic, it's going to increase strain on the metro system, and we're just not built to support that
and
type of population.
That reminds me of something I wanted to say a while ago. I think a couple of comments ago, you characterized the purpose of public transportation to be enfranchising low-income people with mobility. I think that is one of the purposes, but I don't think that city planning offices universally see that as the primary goal of urban transportation. So there is that, but there's a more specific objective of reducing traffic, and they may not care whose traffic you're reducing, because maybe they're concerned about environmental externalities, the visual landscape of the city.
Noise is real, yeah.
Commute times are, you know, bad for health. We kind of touched on that. But I think characterizing the primary goal as enfranchising people with mobility is not wrong morally, but wrong technically.
Yeah, it's me being too idealistic for the reality.
Yeah, exactly. That's so you have to look at other goals of transportation departments and planning departments.
My fear is, because you were talking about how they predict like there's going to be like 1.5 million people. I think my fear is how much we're gonna start considering places suburbs of DC. Because we all live in you live in the city, but the rest of us live in like a suburb, what's considered a suburb of DC. And so I'm wondering how far that reach is gonna go, and how much we're gonna be putting public transportation out that far, or if we're gonna put public transportation out that far. And
should we?
And should we? And, how expensive is that? Because, listen, Alexander aren't cheap. It's cheaper than, I guess, living in the... But it's not like it's cheap. You know what I mean? So, I know there's people who, live in West Virginia who commute into D.C. because they're the cost is lower, and they drive into this... Yeah, no, there's real
West
people.
West Virginia.
That's, hours away, isn't it?
I know some people do that. There's, commuter buses you can take.
It's, 2 hours, though. It's a... bit, isn't it?
That's people do that, and so are we gonna get to this crazy point where West Virginia, and not necessarily considered a suburb of DC, but it's considered somewhere where you can live and work then come to work all the time in DC, just like Alexandria is considered a place where you can live but come into DC, and how much is that raising prices? Because we were talking about this previously, but DC's not built for three people to be living in a one-bedroom apartment. But that's what happens because people
need... People aren't built.
No, I mean, fair. Like, I have no intention of ever doing that, but that's what's happening. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember visiting friends that went to college down here, and it's like one person sleeping on an air mattress in the living room, and two people shared the bedroom, and it's like they had no other furniture in their apartment, maybe like a sofa, because that's all they could afford, but they need to be close to school. So, like...
So to your previous point, one of my coworkers commutes from Warrenton, which is about 45, 50 minutes south. And Warrenton, so he drives and then he gets off in Springfield's in Maryland, right?
No, Virginia.
So I think he gets off in Springfield, takes the train in from Springfield. Okay. I don't know his exact transit route. I'm not good with maps. But in his town and north of his town, development companies are buying up land to build big developments in anticipation of not only DC spreading, but Fairfax, right, is supposed to be a DC suburb, but there's so many people living there now where it's its own center. It is robust enough to call a city if you were to take it away from DC. Mm-hmm. It would be a city. It has businesses, it has business parks, it's got public transit, it's got everything that a city has to be self-contained. So now there's suburbs for those suburb hubs.
So
it's not even that DC itself is spreading, it's spawning little DCs, you know, transplants from all over the country that are coming here for prospecting jobs or whatever, tech companies relocating, all sorts of stuff.
Yeah.
So
I don't think that's necessarily bad though.
I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm just saying that I think is the path forward for DC is just metastasizing outside of our constitutionally guaranteed boundaries into other states.
Well, I think cities, well, especially cities with lots of jobs and opportunities like DC, New York, Chicago, will have to decide how much they want to focus on expanding transportation to those kind of outer communities. Or alternatively, a cheaper route might be to deter transportation from there. So instead of building more subway lines, which may be a goal eventually, a thing like congestion pricing could say, all right, like, we're going to try to deter you from bringing your car right to your job. Maybe bring your car to, like your coworker does, bring your car to a subway stop, park it there, and then you can ride into the city, but we don't want your car in the central business district.
I'm curious about the public-private partnership space in transportation, and I read about, I think in Denver, they're building a light rail to the airport as a public-private partnership, and the costs have been really low relative to other transportation projects and also completed fairly quickly. So I'm interested if you want to talk about other examples of those partnerships working well, if you have examples or just like generally about their efficacy.
Yeah.
And especially in addressing some of the affordability issues that we've talked about.
I mean, one example of a public-private partnership working really well is in New York with their bike share program. Mm-hmm. So the bike share is called City Bike, CITI, the bank.
Oh, right.
which is a perfect branding opportunity for a bank called City.
Just helping us.
No, don't they
that
brand? They do brand on the bikes.
Yeah, they do.
I was calling Capital Share Bikes City Bikes for a while.
They brand directly on the bikes. And the New York bike share system is the most successful in the country in terms of docked bike shares. So
what's the private like element of that? So is Citibank just
they
co-fund
it.
The cost of
and in exchange, I mean, you get your branding
your brand
on bikes.
And you get to be seen as promoting sustainability.
Yeah.
So
with other systems, like in Colorado, I'm not exactly sure what the trade-off is for the private company. I assume they share in profits.
Sure.
But it is really important in a public-private partnership that the city makes sure that the company assumes some risk.
Yes.
Because the risk can't fall entirely on the city, and then the company is fine if the venture fails.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something that has to be made clear in the contracting and permitting. So in the mid-20th century until like the 80s, there was a lot of federal funding for cities.
Mm-hmm.
Like urban renewal was in some sense a federal project. And then that scaled back a lot
like cities don't get a ton of direct federal funding anymore.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so they have to turn to other funding mechanisms, which it may not always be good, but it's kind of what happens.
Yeah.
The infrastructure is really important
too. And even if the infrastructure is there, like, do people want to use them? Like, mm-hmm. I don't know how much, you know, cities invest in kind of understanding what people feel comfortable using or like what mm-hmm. fits their lifestyle, yeah. but I'm sure that's a component of it as well.
Yeah.
Was there anything else that you kind of came into the conversation wanting to talk about that we didn't get to?
I mean, we talked about so much. I mean, we didn't really touch on dockless bikes.
What is that?
I have a lot of feelings about dockless bikes.
Yeah, so DC is piloting a dockless bike program right now. So traditional bike share programs, you bring it to a port and the port locks it and mm-hmm. you pull it out of, like, you get it out of a port and you return it to a port.
Mm-hmm.
So you have some flexibility on where you're going, but you have to bring it to a port. Dockless bikes they don't have that port. So you pick it up where it's left and then you leave it where you're going.
Whoa.
And then someone comes and gets it.
You haven't seen them?
The good bike? It's crazy.
It's kind of all over the place.
Yeah,
and people are
it's
just
kinda like
mean
Uber
about leaving
for bikes. Yeah.
So in one big problem as you guys have been intubating is parking, that people can leave them in spaces that
the blind should
that
be
may
concerned.
Not be
yeah.
safe.
Right.
Leaving them under cars, in
yeah.
parks of the street, on sidewalks.
Cars? What
I've seen them under cars.
You think it's a game. Like, people just, like, leave. Also,
what?
These bikes are not sustainable. They're made really crappily. So, like, there's no point in fixing them up. Like, say something happens. So, the Capital Bike Shares, those bikes are, like, really well-made,
yeah,
expensive
yeah,
bikes.
You're not going to break those.
So, you don't break them, and if they break, you just maintain them.
Yeah.
But these bikes are so cheap that you don't have to maintain them. And so, what happens is if they break, they just throw them away.
Yeah.
So, they're not sustainable, and they're just kind of a waste.
To push back a little bit, I mean, I haven't done a formal cost-benefit analysis, but if more people are biking, they might be taking fewer cars, presumably,
sure.
So maybe the sustainability gains in emissions reductions might outweigh, I don't know.
They also,
sure,
if they're cheaper, it's possible they use less material.
There are a lot of problems, but
it
also is tied to the public-private partnership idea, because these are private companies. It's not even really a partnership. Cities in general have given permits to private companies to do these.
Mm-hmm.
So the docked bikes in DC are entirely run and operated by the government, whereas the dockless bikes, there's
mm-hmm.
five private companies that are supposed to be in compliance with DC. With the DC permit, and the city council will probably be passing regulations later this year.
Yeah.
But they are not funded at all by the city.
I think the only like bonus for using like the dockless bikes is the fact that you can park them in those lower income neighborhoods,
yeah.
so where the dock bikes aren't, so they still have accessibility to bikes, like a bike share program, or like to get access to like another public transportation. But I think they just also have to set up like a better system for those bikes and maintain those bikes well, so they're more like sustainably friendly.
Yeah.
Also, because that is part of the reason to use a bike share, is to be more sustainable.
Well, Grace, obviously this is an issue that all of us feel very passionate about, and you know,
everyone transports.
It's true. So thanks so much for joining us,
yeah,
Grace,
thank you
for your
me.
Insight. Yeah.
Thank you for tuning in to GEW Wonkcast, brought to you by the Trachtenberg School of Public Policy and Public Administration. For more wonkiness, you can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Our handle on all of those platforms is @GWWonkcast. And you can send us love letters or hate mail by emailing us at wonkcast@gmail.com. And be sure to rate us and subscribe. We're now on Stitcher Radio, Google Play, and iTunes. Today's show was produced by Maggie Gallagher and